Great.
Jennifer's here. Bill Barnett. Ken Jones. Kathy Sulick is here.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth. Chris. Jeff Wozniak.
I'm here.
Hey, Jeff. Sarah's here. Dina. Tatiana. Peter Hammond. Deepak.
No, my name's Caitlin. I'm calling from CHLA.
Okay, hold on, Caitlin. Deepak, are you there? Johan? Tom Donaldson or Kathy Mitchell?
Yeah, Tom's here.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Ed.
Bay Calhoun? John Hannigan?
Present.
Hey, John.
Hi, Ed.
Hannah? Dan Savage? Going to be a little late. Susan Tapert? Dale and Bill?
Yes and yes.
We're here.
Okay. All right, so, Caitlin, I'm sorry. Who are you representing today?
Bird.
I'm sorry, Caitlin. I missed that.
Calling for Dr. Elizabeth Sell.
Okay.
Yeah, I just joined.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. All right. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi.
All right. Anyone else? Bill?
Hey, Ed. Michelle is here.
Okay.
And Bill Barnett, yeah.
All right. Enjoy your time in San Diego, Bill.
I did very much. Thank you.
Tatiana?
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Is that you, Ed?
Peter Hammond?
Hmm?
He may not be on. All right. Anyone?
Oh.
Hello?
Hello.
Who's that?
Tatiana.
Oh, yeah. We got you, Tatiana.
How many times do you have me?
God, if there were clones of you, imagine what the world would be like.
Oh, my gosh, it'd be exhausting. I could be going round the clock.
God.
I have to continue, Tatiana. You're always emailing, like, when it was really late your time.
Yeah, I don't go. My husband's traveling. I don't sleep anymore.
Anyone I missed? All right. Okay, well, we've had few conference calls didn't happen over the summer, so there are some things that we're going to try to accomplish. And so you have the agenda, and so I've asked Sarah to give the presentation she was supposed to do last time, and then we'll go through the rest of the items here. And then some of you I'm going to want to hang on after the official call if it's possible so that we can discuss some of the other issues.
Can Jill send the link out again?
Yes.
Thanks.
Jill?
Can you tell us this after the call, other issues? Is that me, Ed? Am I part of this other issues?
You are.
I am? Okay, because I have to be somewhere, too. That's why I'm asking. Okay.
All right. Well, is that 11 my time?
Yeah.
And I assume I am supposed to be there, too.
We'll try to get it done. All right?
That'd be great.
All right. So, Bill, do you want to send out the link?
Already done.
Okay. And while we're waiting for everyone to get on, Jill, do you want to talk about the NIH public access policy? Or do you need the WebEx for that?
I have a couple things written out, but I can just go through it. I don't know if everyone is aware, but the NIH public access policy, which went into effect in 2008, is really being enforced as of July 1st, 2013. So I encourage all of you to make sure that anything that has been published from your consortium has a PMCID number, or at minimum, if it's within 3 months of being published, has an NIHMS number. If all of this sounds foreign to you, I will send out a small tutorial and some links that will help. Basically, there are two websites you want to be aware of. The first is the NIHMS website. That is the Action Center for obtaining a PMCID number. Depending on which journal you published in and what their publisher agreements are, you will either be using Method A, which the journal submits it automatically, or CRD, where you receive permission from the publisher to either submit it or have them submit it on your behalf. Again, I'll send out a little cheat sheet.
Yes. I would only reiterate that they're very serious about this. For the training grant that I had up for renewal, they were going to withhold the funds until all of them were complete. So they're not kidding around.
And that was not just on articles pertaining to Dr. Riley's training grant. That was on anything of which he was the PI. So they're looking at the PI and going across the board to make sure you're in compliance. So the other website you need to be familiar with is essentially the new ERA Commons bibliography, and that's called NCBI. And that can also... Pardon?
You better send an email out about it.
I will.
No one's going to remember those web addresses.
No, I had it printed out, but okay. Yep, no problem.
Bill, it's my NCBI, to be correct.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Dr. Matt, everybody on WebEx now?
This is Peter. I'm not on yet.
Okay. Hey, Peter, how's your mouth?
Coming on. Still got a gap in it.
All right. Well, we've all been there. All right. So, Dr. Mathen, you want to share your desktop? Everybody see that?
Yeah, looks great.
Everybody see it?
Yep.
All right.
Okay.
You're there 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Okay. So I really just wanted to update you on some of the things we've been doing lately. And the primary focus of the data I'm going to present have to do with identifying the specificity of the neurobehavioral profile, which, as you all know, is something we've been working on for a while. So this is just what I'm going to talk about. Why do we need a profile? I think you all know why. Why is specificity important? And then mostly I want to talk about some of our recent studies. Okay, so our neurobehavioral profile is something that CFAS has been working on for a long time, the reason we need one is to improve our identification of affected individuals, particularly those who don't have the facial features. So as you know, having the facial features required for an FAS diagnosis allows that diagnosis, but many children who are affected by prenatal alcohol exposure don't have those facial features and therefore don't receive that diagnosis. So we're searching for a neurobehavioral profile that will allow them to be identified better than they are now. And the reason that it has to be specific is that the neurobehavioral features that we see in FASD also occur in other conditions. So, I think we like to think that FASD is special, but so do people who study ADHD, and so do people who study autism, and there are a lot of shared features across many, many developmental conditions. And so one of the ways that we can further our goal of better identification is learning what is specific to the effects of alcohol and what perhaps is shared across other developmental disabilities. Okay, so I'm going to go through this quickly because this is old news. These are just data that we presented back in 2010. This was from actually CFAS Phase 1, and we showed that we were able to accurately identify children with FAS, but also children who were exposed to alcohol but did not have FAS, and we were able to distinguish them accurately from controls using a broad-based neuropsychological test battery. We did the same thing. In phase, I didn't realize that was going to be animated, and I apologize. I'm just going to put those up. Oh, okay. Now I've done it. We repeated the study in phase 2, but we added an ADHD group, and we wanted to know whether we could distinguish alcohol exposure from ADHD, and we were able to do so with a high degree of accuracy, although not quite as high as in the previous study. But this was using a broad-based study, and we wanted to look at more specific aspects of the disorder. So that's led us to our more recent studies. And in these studies, we're looking at kids who have histories of heavy prenatal alcohol exposure, and many of them have ADHD, but some of them don't. And because of the CFAS consortium, because of the large sample size that we've been able to collect on our test batteries, we're able to look at these subjects in a 2x2 design. So alcohol exposure, you have it or you don't. ADHD, you have it or you don't. And that leads us to these four subject groups. So just to take you through it, can you see my cursor right here?
Yep.
Okay, so that's this group right here, what we call, what we're calling AE plus. These are kids with alcohol exposure and also ADHD. AE minus are the kids who have alcohol exposure but don't have ADHD. And then our ADHD group is no alcohol exposure with ADHD, and our controls are no on both factors. Okay, so that's going to be our design for most of the rest of the studies that I'm going to talk about.
Sarah, is alcohol exposed defined by a particular level or diagnosis?
It's not defined by a diagnosis. We use a definition of heavy prenatal alcohol exposure, which is approximately greater than 13 drinks per week. But as you know from our studies, that's not precise in every single case. We often have diagnoses of alcoholism or alcohol dependent and so on.
Thank you.
But it's not the light or even, I wouldn't say, moderate exposed.
Okay.
So in a study that we published last year, we looked at adaptive behavior, which is a domain of functioning that has been pretty well studied in fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And it's one of the domains that is particularly affected in this condition, but it's also affected in other conditions as well. And so it was a good place for us to start in terms of looking at this level of looking for specificity. So we use the Vineland Adaptive Behavior Scale, which is an interview that's administered, and actually in this case it's a questionnaire that's administered to the parents to look at adaptive behavior. And in this slide particularly talks about the children's ability to communicate with other people, to communicate their needs, and so on. And what we see, so this is our four, these are our four groups that I talked about. This is our AE plus group. This is our AE minus group. This is the ADHD group, and this is the control group. And you can see that there's a the group that has both ADHD and alcohol exposure has the worst performance. And in fact, it was there was a significant interaction, and this group was significantly more affected than the other three groups. Although we do see deficits in the ADHD group as well, having both conditions led to the worst and significantly worse performance. We also looked in a separate study that was published this year at externalizing behavior and psychiatric diagnoses. And in this case, we see that kids with both conditions in the AE plus group have significantly worse externalizing behaviors. So this is also on a questionnaire. This is a parent-rated questionnaire. Again, ADHD subjects without alcohol exposure have significantly worse externalizing behavior. So this is sort of acting out types of behaviors, but we see a significant difference here as well. What?
Is this the CBCL?
This one's from the CBCL. The last one was from the Vineland. Okay, then we looked. No, so this is a different outcome. This is the sluggish cognitive tempo scale, which is a measure we've been using since the beginning of CFAS, and it looks at a specific group of behaviors that are associated with ADHD but may be somewhat unique from ADHD. And what we see here is that it's having ADHD that causes the worst, the poorer performance on this scale. So here, this is our AE plus and this is our ADHD group. They both have poorer scores than the other two groups. There is a significant difference between our AE minus and our controls, but it really looks like it's the presence of ADHD that's driving these elevated scores. So this perhaps is not a specific finding, although there are some other interesting findings in this study that that show us that we can actually identify alcohol-exposed kids without ADHD using four of the items on this scale. So that's kind of interesting in a separate way. And then we looked at, in that same study where we looked at externalizing behavior, we also looked at psychiatric diagnoses. And this was interesting. We found an elevation. So ADHD is associated with conduct disorder generally, but it's highly associated with conduct disorder in the presence of alcohol exposure. So children with alcohol exposure, both alcohol exposure and ADHD, have this high rate of conduct disorder. So that's also an externalizing behavior, and that goes along with the findings that I showed you a couple slides ago. But it's sort of unrelated, but interesting as well. They have a lower rate of major depressive disorder, whereas the ADHD kids have a higher rate. So those are two.
So lower than ADHD, but not of control.
Not of control, right. It's still, that's a great point, John. Thank you for pointing that out. They definitely still have elevations in this area, really regardless of ADHD, but it's lower than you see in the ADHD population. So that's something that might be interesting for follow-up in a more detailed study. But they do have this really highly elevated rate of conduct disorder.
Remind me what ODD is, please.
Oppositional defiant disorder. Another externalizing behavior.
And is it surprising that the control, I don't know how large the sample size is, but that there was the zero values for the controls for three of these? Is that, I mean, it was really zero?
No, it's just it's a very low rate. It's, you know, the average number of diagnoses they have is 0.04. So there's, you know, there's a smattering of kids here and there. We do, so I should point out that we eliminated from the control group any child who had even partial symptoms of ADHD. So this is a pretty clean control group, which may be why we don't see that. But they're pretty, you know, healthy.
Sarah, how many kids were in the control group, do you remember?
It's on the next slide. I can't tell you off the top of my head, but it was in the – hold on, we'll just – it was over 100.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and this is from a different study, but it's the same database, so it's going to be fairly comparable. So those studies led us to look at, those are all behavioral studies, mostly parent report, that talking about the outcomes in their kids. And so what we wanted to do was look to see whether we found the same pattern of findings when we looked at our neuropsychological testing. So this is testing that's done directly with the child and not indirectly through the parent. So we did the same sort of design where we have four groups, the AE plus, AE minus, ADHD, and control. And you can see, my slide got cut off, but our measure is a comprehensive neuropsychological test battery, which includes both intellectual functioning and mostly executive functioning. So just an overview of the results, and I'll show you a little bit more of the details, was that we, unlike our previous studies, which were the parent reports of behavior, our neuropsychological results did not indicate that having both alcohol exposure and ADHD resulted in worse outcomes than having alcohol exposure alone or ADHD alone. We did find, so we analyzed our data using a 2x2, a series of 2x2 Mankovas, and we did find interactions between the two factors on six of the measures, but in all cases, the two alcohol-exposed groups were not different from each other. So the AE plus with ADHD and the AE minus without ADHD are the same. And on two of those six measures, the kids with alcohol exposure or the group with alcohol exposure were worse on verbal comprehension and perceptual reasoning, and I'll show you the data in a minute. And on four of the six, they didn't differ from ADHD. So having alcohol exposure or ADHD, so again, those would be and I got cut off. I'm sorry. That would be a sort of nonspecific finding because both ADHD and alcohol exposure, regardless of ADHD, result in deficits on these four measures, which you can't see because they're cut off. So this is an example of some of the data that we see. I'm sorry, getting over a cold. Of the data from this study. So this was These are actually the verbal comprehension performance data, but it's not labeled. But so here you can see the AE plus group and the AE minus, and there's no difference between them. And here's the ADHD group, so still deficient from controls, but our alcohol-exposed groups are significantly worse than ADHD. So we have an interaction, but it's seems to be due to the fact that the effect of ADHD is larger in the non-exposed groups than it is in the exposed sample. Make sense? No? Okay. All right, so just to wrap it up, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions. What we've done so far several studies with this same sort of design, and we've got three different sets of outcomes. In some cases, it seems like it's alcohol exposure that's causing these specific findings. In verbal comprehension, and in some aspects of executive functioning, that should be actually perceptual reasoning. Children with alcohol exposure, regardless of their ADHD, have deficits, and they're worse than those seen in ADHD alone. In one case, we see in the sluggish cognitive tempo study, we see that it seems to be ADHD that's causing the significant differences on that measure, although we can still use this measure to accurately identify kids without ADHD, and that's interesting in its own right. And then finally, we have some measures, mostly in parent-reported measures, where alcohol exposure plus ADHD is causing a worse outcome than either of those conditions alone. So having the combination of alcohol exposure and ADHD puts some children at greater risk for developing difficulties in communication abilities and particularly in externalizing behavior problems. So that's all I have. But I'd be very, very happy to hear any questions.
Yep. Sarah,
it appears that the AE alcohol plus group and having ADHD makes you worse, according to the parent report, mm-hmm. that behaviorally you don't really see a big difference between the two.
You mean
neuropsych battery.
Neuropsychological, that's what it appears.
So the parents are augmenting the child's behavior.
Well,
creating it differently.
They are, but we have some other data that I didn't present, and it's not from. It is from CFAST, but we haven't. We're just getting ready to submit it for publications from phase one, using phase one data, where we compared parent report and laboratory measures.
Mm-hmm.
To see if the parent, to answer that exact question, to see whether parents were accurate reporters. Or are they rating them badly across the board? And what we looked at attention and impulsivity, and what we found was that they were accurate reporters when it came to inattention, but not when it came to hyperactivity.
So one thing I also wonder, and I think it's all still meaningful, is that our adoptive parents who are aware of the kid's history,
mm-hmm.
you know, sort of over-reporting bad behavior.
You know, I think that's a possibility. One of our issues is that we have so many adoptive and foster parents that it's hard to answer that question.
Yeah, I know.
But at the same time, now it's not really getting at your question of adoptive parents or non-biological parents versus biological parents. But when we look at other conditions, so we've looked at ADHD, and they're reporting difficulties, but not to the extent that are being reported in the alcohol-exposed group. And we actually looked at, in a completely separate study many, many, many years ago, of Down syndrome, looking at behavior reporting or parent reporting of behavior, and there definitely are deficits being reported, but not to the extent. So we are seeing consistently that alcohol-exposed children, the parents of alcohol-exposed children, are reporting elevations in behavior that are very distressing to them. Yeah. Now, whether it has to do with the biological status of the child, I don't think we have the data. Maybe we might. Maybe we have such a big sample, but it's unlikely that we have the power to look at that.
We
have time for one more question.
Sarah, it looks like there might be a ceiling effect for some of the data that you showed, that the inability to see a larger effect of alcohol plus ADHD over ADHD alone might represent that, simply because the alcohol exposure alone was higher than the control.
Mm-hmm. So this slide that I have up right now was one of the. I don't know if this is the one you were talking about, but the actual maximum score on this scale is 3. So we're not. It's definitely not in this case due to a ceiling effect.
Because clearly there's an alcohol effect.
Yeah, clearly there's an alcohol effect, right.
I couldn't conclude from these data that ADHD is the only effect. It may be that it's a combination. You can't really look at that and sort that out, because clearly there's an alcohol effect by itself.
Yes, there's definitely an alcohol effect by itself, and if we combined our alcohol-exposed kids with and without ADHD, you know, the mean would be even higher. But I think that in this case, it's the I understand what you're saying, but I think in this particular case, it is the ADHD that's driving these really elevated scores. No, you're right. It's not, and it's just like John pointed out on the psychiatric disorders. It's not that alcohol's not having an effect. There was definitely an effect. That was in the major depressive disorders, that there was definitely an elevation in comparison to controls. But in that case, the ADHD kids had higher disruption.
Okay. I think we're going to have to move on if we want to try to get through some of these other things.
Well done, Sarah.
Thank you.
Yes, Sarah.
And any questions or comments or anything, please, I'm very, very happy to hear them. Just send them, call me or email me.
A good list of public population. I know that the genetic or the saliva sampling group has been very active, and would one of the people participating in that like to bring us up to date?
Well, I could.
I'm here.
And Tatiana. But the issue came up where we were all, for a long time, and all in agreement collecting the DNA samples. And it came up more recently that we were interested in looking at sex differences and gonadal hormones from my perspective. And then it became apparent that Deepak was also interested in getting hormones from saliva samples, but different hormones. So we talked we've been back and forth a lot. And Tatiana, maybe you could fill in on...
Yeah, let me try to put this into maybe a broader context. And
yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of interest in saliva for a couple different reasons. Elizabeth alluded to the DNA that we've been collecting from the Origine kit. And then both Elizabeth and Deepak have interest in testosterone in both cases, but in each case some different hormones that can be measured from the saliva. And so we've discussed the amount of saliva that we've been needed, we've discussed coordination of results, and what we want to stress is that we would like to have all the, I think it's only U.S. sites that we're talking about, participate. And what we've really sat down and tried to think about is how can we do this in a way that will create the least amount of impact, work, et cetera, for the site. So what we did is we looked at what saliva was needed, how it might be collected, how could we coordinate efforts. And so I've got this lovely little chart that I've made, and just to summarize it, not that everyone sees it, but I don't think you need to see it in order to understand it. So there's an Origine kit for DNA. That's my selfish need. It can be collected at any time. It has no time sensitivity. Both Elizabeth and Deepak are collecting a saliva sample that optimally would be collected in the morning because of circadian variation. In discussing it, because of the way the samples would be tested and processed, we actually found a way that they could each use a slightly different tube, which would be, all this will be provided to the sites, and I'll get into that next, but that'll be really obvious which tube is for which investigator. So Elizabeth needs a 1 mL cryovial, and Deepak needs a 0.5 mL cryovial. So they're going to look a little different. And what they will do is it's just this, you know, you have the saliva kind of, I hate to say it's kind of graphic, but, you know, kind of drips into the tube. And so there's time for collecting it, but we really ideally want to have that in the morning. The most important thing is it will be accompanied by a form. So if, and the form will indicate when it was collected, time of day, and, of course, when it was collected. And we recognize that some people see subjects in the afternoon, and we realize that. So a morning collection is just not going to be possible. But if we have that information about when it was collected, then that will allow us in the future when we see results from these analyses to say we can potentially co-vary, if we can, effects of time of collection, or if we just see that results are too discrepant, we'll have a way to do that rationally. Everyone totally recognized that this is adding additional work for the sites. So what we talked a lot about on the call, and it sounds like Elizabeth's done a really nice job, is creating a protocol for collection, processing, storage, and shipping. And so what we did is we asked Elizabeth to share with Deepak the materials she's prepared so that he can prepare similar material, because his sample, remember, it's a slightly different tube, and it's actually going to ship to a different place. His sample, the smaller mill tube, is going to go to his laboratory, and Elizabeth's is going to Salimetrics. But really, in truth, how you process it, how you store it is all going to be the same, how you collect it's going to be the same, and just where you ship it is going to be different. So we hope, I think we really want to open this up for discussion, is we really figured if someone was going to be able to do this collection, there's really no difference in what's going to need to be done. It's overall 1.5 mL of saliva. I'm happy to move DNA for saliva to later in the day if that's too much for people to provide that much saliva all at one time. But I think it really doesn't make sense to say I'm going to do one and not the other. And so in the spirit of that, Jeff Wozniak actually had a great consent that he used. He doesn't say where the sample's going to go. He just talks about a sample being collected for hormone levels, and that actually covers both of these protocols. He talks about sharing the data, in his case, with Children's Hospital, which is Elizabeth, but also with CFAS. By doing that, that means it covers Deepak's collection as well. So I think it's actually, if we'd like to use Jeff Wozniak's language, it's actually great language. It allows both collections to be done. He actually talks about 2 mL of saliva, and in fact, it's only 1.5 mL. And so I actually think that we could do this very simply by just doing a very broad statement in the consent and in the protocol about collecting saliva, not only for DNA extraction, but also for hormone levels. And like it always is, it's best not to be too specific about where you're shipping it and exactly which hormones you want to do. I think it's always a mistake to be too specific, because it gives you very little flexibility. And as far as the subject's concerned, whether you collect DHEA or testosterone, it's hormone levels. I don't think it matters to them if it's 4 or 5. They're really consenting for the same thing. So I think that the proposal we have on the table is to ask the U.S. sites if we could expand saliva collection to include these 1 mL and 0.5 mL saliva collection. It'll be provided to you with packets and with kits, so that hopefully it will be quite easy to do. There'll be instructions on how it will be shipped. We'll have collection information. And so I hope this is something that we could kind of see what people think, but that we hope we can take forward.
Hey, thanks, Tatiana and Elizabeth. You will send out a protocol that people can look at and get.
Yeah. So Christina,
Elizabeth already got that ready. Is Deepak on the phone?
Yeah, I'm on the phone. Yeah.
Great. So did you receive materials from Elizabeth?
We already went through these, and there are a couple of little changes took place. They're getting these.
Yeah, you don't have to tell us, but you're going to be able, you'll create the parallel set of materials so the sites can see that as well.
Yeah, I probably don't have to, because what happened is only one material we prepared. We added different color tubes and everything, so everything is going all in one protocol. And in Elizabeth area, well, we have the level and everything, so it's all going to go together. And with a similar protocol, without any problem. Is the color different? There will be blue color, red color, and white color tubing. So so is blue and red color for Elizabeth is male and female, and white color for corticosteroid and testosterone. So that's, we made it very simplified and without any, you know, any differences for any site.
Right. Can I just, can I ask just a quick clarifying question? So what you're saying is that with one, we're going to have one consent document.
Yep.
And three collections. Yeah. One being the larger collection for DNA, which we've always been doing, and then two separate collections that will be done at the same time.
Yes. Right.
The two morning ones, Elizabeth and Deepak, should be in the mornings.
I don't think that's going to happen at our site because we sometimes do, but we don't routinely test people.
The important thing is that if we document the time,
yep. Right.
That's why.
I understand that. But so what happens if a subject? Okay, so I know Tatiana, that the larger collection, the DNA collection, is not the favorite thing of the subjects to do.
Yes. Favorite? Do you not make it fun?
Oh, we have balloons and streamers and music. It's very fun. But they...
You can give them a little bit of sugar to help start it.
They don't like it.
Sugar for the hormone stuff.
Yeah, you can't have...
Well, we won't be doing it at the same time. But so, yeah. So, yeah. But what happens if after doing the larger collection, they say, I don't want to do it?
So I would suggest that you do Elizabeth and Deepak first. Especially for
We're not doing them. We won't be at our particular site. We won't do them at the same time.
What do you mean by that?
We won't do them because what we routinely do is we do the DNA collection when they come in for neurobehavioral testing. We were gonna do Elizabeth's collection when they come in for the mock MRI, which is close in time to the scan.
Okay.
So we
would do Deepak's at that time.
Yeah, but you would do the pink and blue ones first. Pink or blue one first, but pink or all blue, and then the white one second. And it,
all right. Well, for the time we have,
okay.
You guys are talking about a specific thing at a specific site, so
yeah. Why don't we can email about it separately?
Yep. Okay.
I think you need to send out the protocol.
You're going to send out the protocol.
Well, it's already been sent. Because
all four sites have it?
Yes. Oh, yes. Christina prepared all the packets and all the protocols.
But didn't you say that Deepak made some changes?
I made the changes already, and I sent it to Christina.
Yeah.
And,
so
she has everything.
I haven't received anything from Christina recently.
It's just going to be one more vial, and it's going to have a white lid. Is that
okay?
Right?
So you guys are
okay. We'll get it in the.
Just
we'll
send it out again. It'll be easier. Yeah, just resend
right.
So everyone's got it fresh in their mind.
All right. So is Jennifer on?
Yeah, I'm on. Yep.
All right. Do you have WebEx or no?
I don't have WebEx, but I'm in front of the computer.
I don't know what that means. Can you show the new CFAS website?
So
we could just go to it.
Yeah, so there's an issue this morning. If you go to the CFAS.org site, the homepage is up, but there's the other connections for some reason aren't working. Ian Jungle, who's been doing this, was switching the servers. So we were using one service, and he's switching over to another service, and so I have to assume that that's what's going on because those other pages aren't present right now. Yep. They were earlier, so that's what I can show you right now is just the front page, which you can see if you go to cfas.org. And
screen.
I'm sorry?
I was asking Jill to give it to me. I'll just put it up on mine. Or Jill, can you...
You can share my screen again. I have it open.
Okay, just share... Somebody share their screen.
Jill, can you share my screen?
I changed it to Ed, and now I'll change it to Sarah or Ed. Do you want it?
It's on mine. Can people see my screen or no?
No.
No.
You have to go to Quick Start and Share.
Quick Start and Share. Where the heck is that?
Here, I can do mine.
All right.
Okay.
Except I'm gray, Jill. I think you canceled me. No, I'm now the presenter. Okay. Can you see my screen?
Nope.
You share your desktop.
Share my desktop, yes.
All right.
I'm sharing my desktop. Okay.
Okay.
See it?
Yeah, we see it.
This is our new
There
website.
We are.
Aren't we good looking?
And can you make it bigger, Sarah? Little.
You want it all, don't you?
Like that?
Press the little green dot.
I don't think that makes a difference.
All right.
Because it just makes the sides bigger.
So as you can see, there's this news section, so if people have things they would like to share and contribute, we can put them up on there. Well, go ahead, Jen. You tell them about it. You put it together.
Just tell me where you want me to click it.
Right. Well, right now, if you click on the tabs, what you get is the page isn't found. That's why I was saying that I think he's in the process of changing. They're going to be hosting it themselves. Because what happened was with the videos, they were very, very slow on the service that we were using before. So as a solution, eJungle, which is here at SDSU, is going to be hosting the site. So those things, I have to assume, are in transition because everything was running. But everything was running and looking really great. I want to thank Tina and Tatiana and Leah. And Peter, who sent videos. We have videos available on the education site. We also have a lot of links to videos that are currently present from NOFAS. So those are available on our education site, but I want to just encourage everybody to start thinking about, videos just describing the importance of your work. Again, just a brief video. We talked about this when we had our meeting in June. That would be great. And then also news items. I know Sarah and I have talked about highlighting her findings that she just presented today. So anytime you can send some news items or some videos, video links, things we can put on the education, that would be great.
Okay, thanks, Jen. And hopefully we'll have that up and really working by the end of the day. Is that
okay? I'm hoping. I emailed Ian. Because like I said, I just had checked in with him yesterday. Everything was fine, and he was talking about doing this changeover. So, I'm assuming that's what he's doing right now.
And there really is some nice information on there now with the videos from Leah and Peter, Ken Jones.
Yes, thank you. You guys are awesome. They look great.
Ken Jones almost has his DVD on diagnosis finished, so that will be up there soon. And then I think, we just got to get it out there and let people know that this information is there. We have to update the slide set for general education purposes, but I think it's coming along. Things always take longer than we would like, but that's where we're going.
So I think that what we had talked about in June was really trying to emphasize these short videos, that we thought that would probably be a better way to capture people's attention and engage them and explain what we're doing. So that would be great.
Okay. The recap of CFAS at RSA, I'm not going to really go into that. I did want to ask about the dates in April. I believe that there is a conflict with the international meeting in Vancouver on the week that we asked everybody to hold. And so I'd like to know how many people plan on going to Vancouver for that international FASC meeting. And this is one on prevention.
Which week is that, Ed?
Adult. Let's see. Is...
Week of the 7th.
Thank you.
And the Vancouver meeting, that's the biennial conference on adolescents and adults with FASD, is April 9th through the 12th.
So that's the smaller of the two Vancouver meetings. It's not the one that CFAS presents at. We do that every other year at the other larger meeting. So I was just wondering if it really presents a conflict for anyone but me.
No.
But aren't you important if you have conflict for you?
Yeah, but I could leave. If we have CFest Monday, Tuesday, I'll fly from Washington on Wednesday night, and I'll be there.
Oh, okay. All right. Sorry.
I'll arrange it to work.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Now, we have one issue that I want to talk to certain people about before 11 o'clock here. But are there any really new exciting updates that anyone needs to discuss? All right. Argentina in the Ukraine busily collecting data, and we'll find out what's going on with them. And so the last topic, and anyone's willing to can certainly stay on for this, is that we want to talk about this genetic study, and we need Michael and Tatiana, Peter Hammond, at least to stay on. Anyone else is welcome to join. But I'd kind of like an update on where we are in trying to coordinate the genetic studies and the facial imaging project. And then I need to discuss a potential collaboration with an Australian group.
So who do you need on, Ed?
Well, I definitely need Michael, Tatiana, Peter, and I guess that's it.
Collaborations related to genetics.
Right.
We've been talking with Tatiana and Leah about trying to do something with the brain and genetics. So I'd like to stay on.
Oh, anyone can stay on. But Tatiana, do you want to, or Michael, you want to bring us up to date on the issues and what's going on?
Well, mine is sort of from a piece of it, but we were interested in following up on certain markers that we identified in our cellular studies. And I think that what we had preliminarily suggested some good matches, but the data were going to go through a different process, and I'm not sure where it stopped at that point because I haven't heard anything since probably April or May.
Okay. Ariana?
So this is the data where we had sent you the SNP data.
Yeah.
And you were going to look at it in terms of face shape measures, any kind of measures you wanted to look at. And so we had gone back and forth whether or not you wanted to provide phenotype and we could analyze it, you know, genetics, or, you know, we provided you with the SNP data and then you have the phenotype. And so I think you were interested in learning this, but I guess I just wonder, is this we've talked about it a couple times in between. I mean, we're glad to help. I mean, it's something we know how to do the genetics piece. So I think it's just question of resolving who's going to run the analysis. Do you know what I'm talking about, Peter? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I
didn't realize we were talking about this. I hadn't looked at the agenda, so I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be inarticulate. I'm sorry. I just had to regroup when I heard what the topic was. Okay.
Peter?
Yeah, I've had one preliminary look at the data, and I think the problem for me in terms of driving it from the directly from the face side, sorry if I lisp, it's because I've got a tooth missing, are the numbers in the subgroups are very small. And it might be better if I give the principal component values to someone else who's going to analyze it from the genetics point of view, but pull in the principal component values.
We can certainly do that. We'd be glad to do that.
Yeah,
that's what I do. I mean, that's what I do in my real life as compared to faces.
Okay.
So I'd be glad to do that.
So I think we have an agreement then that Peter will send the principal component analysis to Tatiana. And Tatiana and Michael can collaborate on the analysis then?
Well, I think it would be all three of us. I just want to stress it. It would be a round robin. It's three. All three of us need to work together on this, but I'm glad to do the genetics part. Absolutely.
Okay. So that makes sense? Because I think that could really be interesting.
That would be great because we have another marker that's coming up both in cells and in embryos, and it was one of the ones that had a high hit in the preliminary data that we're looking for. And we're trying to figure out how to package this. If the genetics in human showed a hit, then we would probably include that with the embryo data and with the basic science work as a single paper. If it looked like the genetics was fuzzy, then we would just write another paper along the lines of our PNAS paper, but with a different marker.
Be glad to. I think if we could turn it around pretty quickly, I think if we have that.
That would be great. That would be great.
Can I just ask which marker? Because
it's the Src family kinase family,
mm-hmm.
and the related signaling pathway. So we've identified a number of markers of interest. One of them is the MAP kinase family and the pathway. a second are the ligands that activate Src family kinase. You know, Netrin 1, GDNF, L1, and ADNP or NAP. And then the third is that we're finding that phosphorylation at a Src family kinase site also renders cells insensitive to ethanol, and that there's an appropriate difference in levels. We've done about 30 embryos so far in embryos as well. So that kind of list, and I gave a list related to the work that we've done to Leah along.
Oh, I would love to see it. We can just email. I'm just curious because we've again been working with Tatiana trying to figure out, and Leah, if we can do something with the brain in markers that are.
These are markers that are really more based on brain, and I think we would have loved that, but we didn't have enough. We didn't have a large enough N. So if there is brain to be done, it would be even a better phenotype to match if N is sufficient.
Okay, well, we should talk then as we're working on this idea. No, it's irrelevant to what you're talking about. It's about looking at the brain and genes.
Right. So some of these are candidate genes that might be helpful in understanding variants in brain pathology in children who have similar levels of exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what I suggest is if we could move some of that, if we got the phenotype data, we could begin to look at that. And I'd say we could either do it on the next CFAS call or we could set up a separate call, whatever people would prefer to do. But I think it's exactly the kind of thing we'd love to see move forward.
That would be great.
Great.
And I'd like to be involved, even though I won't say anything, but it'll just maybe help me understand how I might translate it to the brain imaging data. Okay.
Hi, is anyone still on?
I'm still here.
Okay.
Yeah.
Something very odd happened. Both Sarah and I were knocked off at the same time, so I don't know what happened. Neither one of us touched our phones.
Okay.
And Dr. Riley as well, so.
Ed's been talking for about, I don't know, 10 minutes.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Okay.
So I don't know what happened, that some of you stayed on and some of us got kicked off, but. It might have been an SDSU phone system thing. I have no idea. So I just called back in.
Well, does Ed have anything for him to say?
Oh, Ed always has something important to say. Here he
goes. All right. Did you hear about this AGUA project or no?
No.
I did. I mean, you sent me stuff about it, yes?
Right.
But not in his just
All
recent
right.
introduction.
So they have, this is the Australian group, Liz Elliott. They have 1,500 women, primarily on the moderate and low alcohol exposures, but they have 150 women in each category of drinking. So they have six categories of drinking. The majority, 61%,
drank while they were pregnant, but mostly only during early embryogenesis, until they recognized they were pregnant. They have buccal swabs on 90% of the mothers and 47% of the infants, and they have placenta and cord blood samples on 35 participants in each of those exposure groups. They hope to have 300 3D photographs at 1 year of age by the end of this year, and they're interested in collaborating on a program announcement that wants to foster international collaboration. So have you been in touch with Jane Holliday at all?
No, I haven't. I'm sorry, Ed. I've been in meetings all day. I haven't emailed her yet. I mean, I know it's tomorrow, and that's why I'm just – I don't even know what we would be proposing to write in 24 hours. That's what I'm – I don't mean to be negative, but I just don't know how you're going to put something together that quickly.
Yeah, but it's a program announcement. It's not a deadline for an RFA.
Right. That's why this could be done in another – it doesn't have to be done right now.
I think the letter of intent do.
Okay.
But not even required.
Okay.
So they think that this is due October 5th, but I don't know how one writes a grant in a month anyway. So.
Well, not a good one, let's put it that way.
Particularly when you have to collaborate over long distances.
Yeah. I would be very surprised if something could be put together that quickly.
You know, so they have these numbers, though, and I'm not sure whether we're interested in getting involved in this or not. So I'm going to leave that up to you.
Okay. I guess I just want to clarify. I think I could talk to you today. So what I can do is I can contact them. The letter of intent is not necessarily required today, but what we're really talking about is exploring what could be potential questions that we could jointly ask.
Right. And
okay. I'd feel more comfortable knowing that we had a little bit of time to do that. Like we could set up a couple calls and discuss this kind of more sanely.
And Peter, they have 600 one-year-old images, so.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I am not sure what camera they used, but I can send you the email address of this Jane Holliday that you can deal with if you want to.
Okay. Do you think they want a partner to do the analysis for them, or do you think they want someone to tell them how to do it?
I am not sure.
Okay.
I mean, Liz Elliott is a fairly well-respected, she's been knighted or something in Australia for her work on fetal alcohol. She has reasonably good funding from the government. So I think she'd like to just be part of a more global effort. But I'm not sure what resources they have.
Okay.
So it's maybe just something totally out of the blue that they can't.
And this is supposed to be collaborative too, isn't it, Ed? I mean, this isn't supposed to be a one-sided interaction, right? That's the impression
right.
I have.
Oh, it's got to be a joint type of
right.
project. And, you know, the funding goes up to, you know, $500,000 a year. So,
I think it's – that's why I say I think this is the kind of thing where I – so what I would suggest we do is, and you know, not to create – you know, not to put a delay on it, but I think we need a phone call with them, talk about, you know, what are their interests. I know they talked about having done – I think she mentioned having done some – I think methylation studies is something that they had done. So I thought it'd be important to kind of hear what they had already done, what their interests were, what their results were, and kind of go – is that right? I mean, I want to go about this in sort of a more – you know, what are the important scientific questions you could ask?
All right. So I'll send Peter the email, and then I'll leave it up to you two to get in touch with her. I'm leave the country tomorrow morning. So
okay.
I'm going to be out of touch for but they want to set up a Skype or a teleconference to discuss in detail.
Okay.
And so they're certainly open to that, and I'll leave it up to you guys to try to figure it out.
Do you want to be on the emails when we discuss this, though, don't you, Ed?
Yes, please. Just copy
okay.
me in.
I just want to make sure. I'm glad to do that.
I mean, I just, you know, I'm not at the stage in my career where I'm going to collaborate on a five-year project, you know. So.
You're young, Ed. Don't say that.
Yeah, don't believe it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Who's still on?
Hannigan.
I'm still on, yeah.
Okay.
All right. So, Bill and Dale, are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
All right. Do you have any comments on this? Or?
I have not, but that sounds like an interesting potential collaboration. It's a shame that the timeline's tight. As I think Ed mentioned, and maybe Tatiana as well, the letter of intent is not a requirement of applying, but it's a courtesy to the review group so they can see what's coming.
Do you feel like with that, if we don't do that, do you feel like we have to have one in the next 24 hours?
I don't think you're really judged on this.
Okay.
And, yeah, and you can give them a heads up maybe when your thoughts are pulled together better.
I mean, they have people ready to write. So, you know, it may be that it's possible to do, but I don't know.
I don't think I can commit to that fast to turn around. I'm going to be honest. I'm in the middle of doing a grant right now. I just don't think I could get another grant done. I mean, I'm
all
efficient,
right,
but I'm not that efficient.
Well, is this one that has a recurring receipt date?
I think it does. It says the standard dates. That's why I didn't think this had to be like this very second.
Yeah, this is
that with a
program announcement. So I think you need to talk with them and go from there, all right?
Okay.
And you might get a trip to Australia out of it.
Well, there you go. That's what I live for. Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
All right.
Take care.
Take care.
Great.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
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 Bye.